This morning, happy Mother's Day. I don't have a particularly Mother's Day-ish message this morning, but Pastor Walsh is going to be doing that in our main service, so we're looking forward to that. We're going to be continuing on our Jeremiah series here in our Sunday school class, and so we're going to be trying to finish off Jeremiah's next message today. If you didn't get a handout this morning, raise your hand, and our guys in the back, one. If you didn't get a handout on your way in, I think we got everybody. Well, very good. We'll take your Bibles and open up to the very, very end of the book of Jeremiah, chapter 9, and then we will be going through the rest of chapter 10, and we'll be finishing up his message. The end of chapter 9 in Jeremiah, and then through chapter 10 is where we're going to be. Jeremiah is on his third sermon. He's in this section of the book. He's preaching about the indictment against the people of Judah. He's telling them what it is that's going on wrong in their nation because they think everything's okay. Just like the gospel, in order to give somebody the gospel, in order to get them saved, to get them lost, to get them to understand where they need to be, he needs them to understand where they are. And so in this particular message, he comes down to the temple that's filled with people doing things, praying, sacrificing, being present, and in spite of the fact he's already told them about their spiritual adultery, all these people doing religious things. And so he's down there to tell them that just because you're doing the religious rituals doesn't mean that God is pleased with you. And if God gives you a message just because you're God's people and you choose not to return, then you will be subject to the same consequences and reaction as the world is. And there's this assumption that underlies the statements that God makes that, yes, God should respond to evil and wickedness in our world. We want him to. We want him to react. We want him to change things. We want him to stop evil. But yet when it comes to us, we expect God to be more merciful. We expect God to react differently when his people. We put a different standard upon ourselves. Should not God judge his people in a more merciful way? And it makes sense that he ends his third message here with the subject that he does in chapter 9. Now, I'm going to try to make this message short because it is simple, and I only have points, and I don't think I have any subpoints, so we'll try to be as quick as possible. But this is something that the people of Israel were assuming would be true. We're us, so obviously the consequences to our actions are going to be different. Remember in chapter 8, verse number 11, he says this twice. It says, they healed the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying peace, peace, when there is no peace. The word slight doesn't mean a little bit, like they did it slightly. They did it in slight. They did it deceptively. They healed our hurt in deception by telling us that things will be okay, even though they won't. Why do they assume that? Because we're Israel. Here we are at the temple. But what he says in this passage is simple. After telling them, hey, your wickedness brings consequences in spite of your religiousness, he then takes this last chapter to compare them to the world. Simply to make this point, if you act like the world acts, if you are like the world is, then you will get what the world gets. It would follow naturally. Just recently, I was writing a little portion, not a long paper or anything like that, but I was writing a small discussion on the problem that the world and even a lot of Christians would have with the killing of the Canaanites. So When we're studying our Bible and God tells the nation of Israel to go into the land of Canaan and drive them out, it seems very violent. It seems very unkind. And the effect that we can get from this also is that for some reason God hates the Canaanites because of their nationality or the color of their skin, and he doesn't want them anymore, but he loves Israel instead. And there's a lot of problems with it, and there's a lot of misunderstandings in that conversation, but one of the essential of that conversation is this, that his biggest issue with the Canaanites was not who they were, but it was what they were doing. It was the life they were living. And if we actually just stop for a second and look at the type of society that they had, it was very, very wicked. They sacrificed children to their gods when they were alive. Besides all the sexual immorality that abounded in their land. But one of the essential parts of this conversation is also this simple truth. That just as God drove out the Canaanites for all of their wickedness, he will do the same thing to his own people when they lived wickedly. You fast forward several hundred years, and when God gives them a merciful time period to do the right thing, and they don't, he treats them the same because they acted the same. And that's what he does with these prophets. He tells them, if you're going to be like the world is, then don't expect God to respond differently to you. We cannot leave the blessings of God and not expect the curse of the world any more than the world does. In the book of Acts chapter 10, in a positive sense, Peter poses this the opposite way. Peter, a Jew, one of God's chosen people, looks at Cornelius and his group of people, a bunch of Gentiles. And Peter said, of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of persons. In every nation, he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is accepted with him. And just as it wasn't that God was going to accept Israel and not accept the Gentiles, it's not that God's going to reject the Gentiles or reject the world and not reject his own people when they act the same. If you accept God, God will accept you. If you don't, then he won't, and it doesn't matter who you are. And he says, if you're going to be like them, you're going to get with them. So, very quickly this morning, we have to ask ourselves the question, are we expecting ourselves to live the life of the world, but shed the consequences of the world? Are we expecting to live the life of the world and shed the consequences of the world? And so we're going to see two ways that Jeremiah says that Israel was like the world and the response that he has. So, number one, just like the world is, we are, or at least we can be, unsanctified. Unsanctified. The world is unsanctified in name. They don't claim to be followers of God. They don't claim to be set apart to God. That's what sanctified means. But the Jews were unsanctified in their heart as well, and so can we be. So I want us to read the very, very end of chapter 9. Chapter 9 really begins this discussion. Verse number 25. We're just going to read verse 25 and 26. He makes a very simple point here, so I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it. Verse 25, he says this, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will punish all them which are circumcised with the uncircumcised. Now, that doesn't seem fair. See, the circumcision was a sign that went all the way back to Abraham. I've already told you this, and he made this simple point earlier. All the way back to Abraham, it was a sign on all the baby boys that they were God's people. It was an outward, a physical, a purposeful sign that we belong to God. And this symbol was associated with being a Jew, and then that would be the label you'd give on everybody else. Remember David, where he walks up to Goliath, and he's hearing all the things Goliath is saying against the God of Israel, and so David looks at the soldiers and says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Remember that statement? That was the label of all those who are not set apart to God. They have rejected God. They have not chosen to be one of God's people. Okay, so the Jews were, the Gentiles were not. But Jeremiah has already used this illustration a couple different times. Back in chapter 6, I won't have you turn there I'm just going to mention something quickly. But back in chapter 6, verse number 10, he says, to whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? Their ear is uncircumcised that they cannot hearken. The word of the Lord is unto them a reproach. They have no delight in it. Their ear is not set apart to me so that it is available to listen to the things that I'm saying. So he says here, I will punish the circumcised with the uncircumcised. Why? Isn't that unfair? He's going to punish his people who have set apart themselves to him with the people who haven't. If you're still in verse, if you're still in chapter 9, look at verse 26. He says this: Egypt and Judah and Edom, the children of Ammon and Moab, and all that are in the utmost corners that dwell in the wilderness, for all these nations are uncircumcised. They have chosen to not outwardly, publicly, purposefully say, I am one of God's people. And look how it finished. All the house of Israel are uncircumcised in heart. So this is what he says. You might look different on the outside, but on the inside, you are the same. Just because you try to do the things that make you associated with God, just because you stamp the label Christian in front of your name doesn't mean that your heart is any different. And Christianity and following God and everything he's gone from beginning to end has never been about the outward. I mean, even in the law, where we feel like the law was about the outward, he says when he reiterates the law and clarifies the law in the book of Deuteronomy, he says, what's the most important law? In chapter 6, he says, to love me with all your heart and soul and mind. This is where everything comes from. And he says, so Jews, if you're going to sit in your temple and you're going to do your sacrifices and you're going to pray and you're going to do your rituals, but your heart is not set apart to me, then you're the same. You're the same as the rest of this world. And if you expect me to punish the uncircumcised in reality, then you should expect me to punish you who are uncircumcised in heart. This is very similar to the Pharisees. I gave you a passage in Matthew chapter 23. Where there's a false sense of security behind doing religious rituals, doing outward things. This is what the Pharisees were to the utmost degree. Everything was outward, but they had nothing inward. Matthew 23, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees. He says, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin. We all have it in our pantries, don't we? So they would go to harvest their seasoning and their spiritual. We're supposed to tithe because we're spiritual people. So they would scoop off a tenth of their cumin, literally, a tenth of their anise, and they would take that down to the temple and they would tithe it because they're very, very spiritual people. So they pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and of omega. Weightier matters of the law, like judgment and mercy and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Yep, tithing, fine. Don't not love your neighbor because you brought me a teaspoon of seasoning this morning. This is what he's saying, but they felt they were spiritual because they were trying to apply the law to every corner of their life. But they are omitting all the things that were important. He goes on, ye blind guides, you strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. You get upset with somebody if they didn't tithe their seasoning, but you're not going to even worry about whether or not you're loving God with all your heart or your neighbor as yourself. You'll swallow a camel, but strain at a gnat. Verse 25, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Ye make clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Blind Pharisee, cleansed first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. So you're going to walk around, you're going to pour coffee in your mug, and you're worried that the outside of the mug that you carry around the house is clean, so everybody thinks that you have clean dishes, but you actually never wiped off the inside with the leftover coffee from the last 3 weeks. It says, you know what's more important? Wipe the whole cup, sure, but you're going to drink out of the inside. Nobody's drinking out of the outside of the cup, okay? Nobody pours coffee on the outside of their mugs and tries to lick it off of the outside. That's not what's important. And he says, so start with the inside. But that's not what we do, is it? Because nobody sees the inside. Everybody sees the outside. So we clean the outside and leave the inside full of extortion and excess. This is what the Pharisees, he goes on, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're likened to whited sepulchres. Indeed, full outward, full of dead men's bones, all uncleanness. Even so, ye also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within you're full of hypocrisy and iniquity. In the Jewish culture, they didn't bury people in the ground. Remember, Jesus was put in a tomb, and they rolled the stone. How many caves do you think are around in Israel where you can keep burying dead people? You run out of the space. But they wouldn't do it that way. They would bury somebody in a tomb. They would leave them there for a year. After they would decompose, this is just their way, they would take their bones and they would disassemble them and put them in a box. It was an ossuary. The box was as big as your biggest bone, which is your femur. So that was so you would have stacks of boxes. And often the boxes would go back into the tomb. So there would be a place where somebody was buried ceremoniously, and then the tomb would be filled with all of your ancestors as well. Kind of like a mausoleum would be today. And so what would you do? Because you want to honor the deceased, you would make beautiful the box. We found ossuaries to this day that have carvings and pictures, names scratched and carved into the side, but it's a box with a dead person in it. And he says, Pharisees, that's what you are. You're so important about all the carvings and outward appearance, but inside you're dead. He goes on. Verse 29, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye be witness unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. You know, it's funny. We idolize people in the past, and we lift them up. We recognize their spiritual contribution to Christianity or whatever. But people during their day shouted them down. They were too zealous. They were too radical. They were preaching the Bible too much. And we look back on them and we lift them up. And he says, but if you were living in those days, you would have been one of the ones throwing the stones. You would have been one of the ones killing them. You want to associate with them. But at the end, you are just like those who shouted down truth when it was uncomfortable to be heard. You wouldn't have appreciated it either. It isn't about the way we appear or what's on the outside. It's about whether our heart is truly sanctified. We're not asking this morning if you come to church or if you pray or if you give or if you sacrifice your time, your energy, or your money. That's what they were all doing in the temple that day when he preached this sermon, chapters 7 through 10. We're not asking if we wear the suit and the tie or polish our shoes or wear a skirt to church or every day. We're not asking if we have a fish on our car or a bumper sticker that says honk if you love Jesus, or we have a decal above our couch that says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. We are not asking if we teach or if we ride a bus or if we went on the Dover Blitz. We're asking if our heart is set apart to God. Because often you can have all of that and not the others. Because that's exactly what the Pharisees did. Everything was fine in their appearance, but their heart was not. And so he says they are blind guides. They are hypocrites. They are like snakes devouring people. This is how he describes them. What is important to you? That's the question. What do you love? That is the question. What is your goal? That is the question. Because often we can make broad our phylacteries and enlarge the borders of our garments like the Pharisees do and still have an uncircumcised heart. And so if we are like the world, regardless of how pharisaical we are, we will get what the world gets. Number two, we are unsanctified. Number two, we fear the same gods. We fear the same gods. The world worships their so for a reason. So we're in chapter 10. Look at verse 1 and 2. Hear ye the word of the Lord, which the Lord speaketh unto you, O house of Israel. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the ways of heathen. Okay, good. Look how he finishes this. Be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them. That was odd that he puts those together, doesn't he? Don't learn the way of the world. Don't be dismayed at the same things the world is dismayed with. Why did the world worship their idols and their gods? Because things happened in nature and in life that were uncomfortable, right? Okay, so storm happened, and it ruined my crops. I was about to harvest, and there was a terrible windstorm, and all of my wheat blew over and dropped all of its grain. Or we were doing really well. We didn't get enough rain, though, this season. Or we got too much rain this season. Or a hurricane came. There was a drought, or there was a sandstorm. Sorry, our fellows are coming by. If you could drop your attendance slip in, we'd appreciate that. Just be ready for them when they come around. So what did they do? They started to associate all of the natural things that they feared with gods that were responsible for them. This is true in like every ancient polytheistic culture. There was the god of fertility, which was they would give enough rain or not so that our crops could grow or not, or we could have children or not. There was the god of the ocean or the sea. There was the god of the clouds or of the storms. And so if we wanted those areas that we feared to go well, we would appease those gods so that they would smile upon us or at least not get mad at us and make our lives more difficult. So they feared things in life. So they worshiped their gods in order to counteract that. Verse number 3. So what did they do? So they compiled idols to appease these gods that they were dismayed with the signs of heaven. Verse 3. The customs of the people are vain. Describe some of the things they would do. One cutteth a tree out of the forest, the works of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers that it move not. They are upright as the palm tree, but they speak not. They must needs be born, because they cannot go. Be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither is it in them to do good. He mocks the whole concept. They fear the signs of heaven, so they make their own gods. And how do they make their own gods? They have to go into the woods. They got to cut down the tree. They got to carry the tree. They have to prop it up so it doesn't fall over. In order to make it pretty, they have to deck it with silver and gold. It can't move anywhere. It can't even stand on its own anymore. But then they fall down after this idol that they have made, and then they worship it. And it says it can't even do anything. It can't hear you. It can't see you. But they worship it because it's something tangible that they can touch, and it gives them a false sense of security. For as much as there is none like unto thee, O Lord, thou art great. Thy name is great in might. Who would not fear thee, O King? Thee that appertain. For as much as among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there is none like unto thee. But they are altogether brutish and foolish. The stock is a doctrine of vanities. Silver spread into Tarshish, gold from Uphaz, and the work of the workmen in the hands of the founder. Blue and purple is their clothing. They are all the work of cunning men. This is what he says. There's nothing. They sit there and they fear the nature. They fear the world. They fear the things that will inevitably happen. And so in order to appease themselves, they will find something that they can touch, and they will worship it as their God. And he says, but why would nobody fear you, God, who is the king of all the nations? Everything they use, they can trace to its origin. They use silver and gold and fancy cloth in order to make their idols, and you even know where they all came from. That came from that country. That came from that country. All of it's the work of man's hands. And he's like, oh, that doesn't apply to me, because I get it. They made idols. They built idols of wood and stone, and then they worshipped it. I get it, but we don't do that. No, we don't. But neither did Israel all the time, but they also didn't trust God all the time. I originally made this point when I skipped through the chapter, which is what I do first. I read the whole chapter and get the text, and then I make a general point, and then I study it as I go through. My original point here was just that we have the same idols as the world, and that almost sounds the same, but it's different. And then you can easily apply that to we try to find pleasure in the same place. place, or we try to find happiness in the same place, we try to find joy in the same place, or fulfillment, or whatever. But that's not the picture he paints here. Don't be like the world, which is dismayed at the signs of heaven, and their reaction is to build an idol. The thing is, we can find ourselves dismayed by the same things in this world as the world is. So our financial situation is not perfect, and we allow ourselves to be overcome by fear of what's going to happen tomorrow. Our political climate is not perfect, and so we can find ourselves overcome by fear of what's going to happen tomorrow, just as the world is. When even the weather is not right, or there's storms coming and they might be harsh, we find ourselves overcome by fear the same way the world is. And so how do we react to those situations? When we fear the same things the world fears, we end up worshiping the same gods the world worships. We fear the state of our economy, so we end up worshiping the political leaders to save us, just as the world does. We fear the loss of our financial security, so we end up worshiping our jobs and our business and our bank account, just as the world does. We fear our lack of security, so we worship our guns and we worship our security systems, just as the world does. We fear our failure, so we worship prestige and education and success, just as the world does. We fear the same things that the world fears, so we worship the same gods that the world worships. I'm not saying don't go vote, or spend money, or buy a gun, or try your best. But don't worship those things as savior, because you fear what will happen if you do not have them. That's what the world does, and that's what we find ourselves doing. So that's why this next section reminds us of who God is. Verse 10. The Lord is the true God. He is the living God and an everlasting king. Kings come and go. It's policy changes. We find a strange sense of security when policy one time goes our way. Like, yes, everything will be good from now on for at least 3 months, right? But there's the security, but things come and go. Political leaders rise and fall, and things go back and forth. God is an everlasting king. There's something that doesn't change. At his wrath, the earth shall tremble. The nations shall not be able to abide his indignation. Verse 11. Thus shall ye say unto them, the gods that have not made the heavens and the earth, even they shall perish from the earth and from under these heavens. He hath made the earth by his power. He hath established the world by his wisdom and has stretched out the heavens by his discretion. When he uttereth his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens, and he causeth the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He maketh lightnings with rain and bringeth forth the wind out of his treasures. He's the one in control of everything. So if we fear the signs of heaven, then we need to worship the God who's in control of the signs of heaven. And when we fear the political climate and the economy and our own security in our home and our own situation and our own failure, we have to recognize that we need to worship the gods who's actually in control of those things and not prop up our own gods and worship them when we have to be the one to make them continue and work. We have to be the one to go on. Verse 14, every man is brutish in his knowledge. Every founder is confounded by the graven image. For his molten image is falsehood. There is no breath in them. Their vanity, the work of errors. In the time of their visitation, they shall perish. The portion of Jacob is not like them, for he is the former of all things. Israel is the rod of his inheritance. The Lord of hosts is his name. He says, Israel is not what you have. You don't have something perishable to look to. You don't have something corruptible to look to. You have something worthy of worship, who actually has everything under control. So Israel, why are you acting like the world acts and trusting what the world trusts? But we do respect and feel security in and feel safe with the things of this world. Many of the things that the world relies on are not bad. I mean, our political system system is definitely fraught with errors, for sure. People are. But, I mean, it is one of the better ones in human history where there's at least some check and balance. Things can't just be overturned and destroyed overnight. There's value to that. It's not bad, then, to be involved and to vote. It's not bad, like I said a moment ago, to save your money. These are not bad things. If you have you know, a few $1,000s in the bank because you're trying to be wise with your money, you didn't spend them on ice cream last year, then that's a good thing. It's not bad to, you know, lock your door at night and lock your car so that nobody steals your car. It's not bad to do some of these things. But why is it that we trust these things? Why is it the world would do something so foolish as to be dismayed at the signs of heaven, build an idol that they built, they cut it down, they took it somewhere, they made it pretty, they propped it up? Why do we trust these things that are not God? Do you know why I think it is? Because they're tangible. We can touch them. We can see it. We know money is fleeting. Every adult in here knows money is fleeting. The moment something went well, suddenly you had that random bill show up about that thing that broke that you didn't even know was in your house, but it broke, so now you got to replace it. We all know that money is fleeting, but you can count your money, can't you? It's fleeting, but you know how much you have, right? You can pick up a gun, so there's security in knowing what it does and how it works and being able to touch it. You can vote, so we can count votes. We can see our political leaders. We know that they exist. We can kind of sort of gauge what decisions they're probably going to make. We can calculate how many hours we're going to get at work and thus how much we will make from it. There's a tangibleness and there's a security, isn't it? Not only are idols tangible, but idols are also able to be manipulated. See, that was the point. The God of thunder or the God of the storms is going to give me storms unless I do X, Y, and Z. And if I do X, Y, and Z, I will not have storms. The God of fertility won't give me rain, but if I do these things, then it will rain and then I will have good crops. See, the gods of this world were not only tangible, they were manipulatable. That was the whole point. If I do this, I can make them do as I want. Our gods are the same. I can count my money, and I can also withdraw it whenever I please. I can manipulate my provision. The gun that we can touch, we know how to pull the trigger. And so we understand how to give ourselves security at that moment. We can vote for those political leaders, so we can manipulate the political climate. So there's, even though we feel outside of control, there's a safety in feeling like it's at least partially in our control. And there's a sense in which by calculating and by manipulating and by knowing how things work and knowing we can work them when we want to, we feel more security in that than in God because it's in us. But we can't force God or guess how God's going to protect us or how. And even though we know he has more power, there's a sense of we don't know what to do with that, because then we just have to, you know, trust him when we don't know what he's going to do. We can't calculate how God's going to provide our needs. We can't. You can count your hours, you can count your money, but you can't calculate how God will take care of you. And we don't like that. And so because we can't touch him, because we can't handle him, because we can't manipulate him, we don't worship him. And we fear the gods the world fears, and so we worship the gods that the world worships. Not because they're more powerful, but because we can touch them and because we can manipulate them. And if we don't have God's help, then we truly are alone. And we will get what the world gets because we have chosen the world's gods. Number three. So those were the things that they chose. Number three. So we must plead for God's mercy. For God's mercy. Judgment's coming. Help, we are lost and at the whims of the world. We've chosen the same path that the world has chosen. We worship the same gods that the world has worshipped. And so then we will get the same outcome. And the fact that that automatically sounds negative just goes to show how foolish it really is. If the world was doing great all the time, we would say, great, I want what the world gets. But they don't. They don't. Verse number 17. Gather up thy wares out of the land, O inhabitant of the fortress. He says, gather all the things that are safe, are important to you, and you're trusting in this fortress because things are not going to be as safe soon. Verse 18. For thus saith the Lord, I will sling out the inhabitants of the land at this once. I will distress them that they may find it home. Woe is me for my hurt. My wound is grievous, but I said, truly, this is a grief, and I must bear it. My tabernacle is spoiled. All of my cords, my children are gone forth from me. They are not. There is none to stretch forth my tent anymore and to set up my curtains. The pastors, the people that are supposed to take care of people, are become brutish. That's a fancy Hebrew way of saying stupid. Have not sought the Lord. Therefore they shall not prosper, and all their flocks shall be scattered. Behold, the noise of the brute is come, and a great commotion in the north country to make the cities of Judah desolate and a den of dragons. Now remember, Babylon is coming, and they would come from the north because that's the path they would have taken over the desert in the Fertile Crescent. Babylon's coming, but Babylon was coming everywhere. Babylon didn't conquer Israel. Babylon conquered everywhere around them. Babylon conquered Assyria, and thus all of Assyria's territory, like Syria and into Turkey. Babylon conquered Egypt. And then, of course, all the other heathen nations around Israel, like Edom, Ammon, Moab, Midian. Babylon wasn't out to get Israel alone. Babylon was trying to take over the world. And they were being successful at doing so. So this is the picture he's painting. So whether or not Israel survives, as opposed to everyone else, is going to be determined by whether or not they had God's help. That was it. God didn't send Babylon to Israel all by themselves. Babylon was already taking over Israel, and God was either going to allow Babylon to do what it did everywhere else, God was either going to allow them to get exactly what everyone else around them got, or he would help them. But whether or not he would help them would be determined by whether or not he was their God. And he wasn't. That was it. Like we say, Pastor's been saying over and over, curse is not God putting something at you or throwing something at you maliciously. Everyone in the world deals with problems, and that's happening all around you. And whether or not it's different for you as an exception to the rule is going to be determined by whether or not God will help you. And that will be determined by whether or not he is your God. So the question is he? Or are we worshiping the gods of this world? So he says we need God's mercy. Jeremiah is the only one, it seems, who will turn to God for help. And this is how his temple sermon ends. Verse 23. O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. O Lord, correct me, but with judgment, not in thine anger, lest thou bring me to nothing. He says, Lord, I know we're not going to do what's right. We need your help. So help us, direct us. But this is what he says. Verse 25. This is Jeremiah's prayer. Pour out thy fury upon the heathen that know thee not, and upon the families that call not on thy name. For they have eaten up Jacob and devoured him and consumed him and have made his habitation desolate. He pleads for God's help. And he pleads for God's mercy. But then he asks for something. He says, God, bring judgment on the heathen and not on us. And Jeremiah asks that very sincerely. They don't know you. They don't have your law. They're the heathen people. Pour out your judgment on them. And he meant well. But Jeremiah does not get the prayer answered. Jeremiah asks that in spite of the fact that he's fully aware that we are just like the world, he asks for his people to get something different than the world gets. But God doesn't answer that prayer because when we act like the world acts, we get what the world gets. And for us to just turn around, and Jeremiah almost by accident, is a perfect example of what he is at the beginning. He says, you want to sit there and ask God for him to undo all of your decisions overnight. And it doesn't work that way. Now, Jeremiah is the only one doing what's right. And God would spare Jeremiah, by the way. He would be one of the very few people to not go into captivity, I think, because he was one of the few people doing what is right. But Jeremiah did not have the license to tell God to please judge everyone around me and not us. Because it doesn't work that way. And so that's his temple sermon. It's one of his indictments. Your religiosity does not change your heart. Your heart is what is important. So the question is, what is our heart like? We're going to move on to his next sermon next week, and so I hope you stick.